Welcome to Good Areas Live. I'm Jared Kimber. This is the Wagga Wheel, the show where we answer your questions on cricket. Today, we've got the Rush Line graphic up here as well, just to show the Ashes. Let's have a look here. They have Australia as a 72% chance of winning in Adelaide. I think I'd like England at a 10% chance here. I think there's something a little bit more interesting in there, as in, I'm not sure England win this game, but I kind of think this might be their best game in Australia now. A lot of this depends on the wicket and everything else. But yeah, you can head over to Rushline, you can download their app, you can find everything out that you need to about them there. They can help you answer questions on cricket, or I can help you answer questions on cricket. If you go over, if you're live with us on YouTube, you can put in super chats at any stage. And we can get to those at the end. But if you are a Patreon subscriber, just at your own leisure, right? Whenever you want to, whenever the mood hits you, you can ask me a question. Go to Good Areas Podcast and you can find us there and help support this channel, the show, humans, all these sorts of things. Like Karen has, who says, the dismissal where the ball takes an inside edge or crashes into the stumps often feels puzzling. Sonny G mentioned on commentary that the key mistake was the batter's front foot not going towards the ball. Could you expand on that? From a technical perspective, how does a front foot alignment and weight transfer increase or decrease the risk of inside edges onto the stumps? I think what he's saying is, if you get an inside edge and your foot is towards the ball, chances are the inside edge will hit your pad. I think he's talking more basic geometry than he is cricket at that point. It's very hard to get bowled off the inside edge if your pad is also in that area, or your foot or your leg is in that area as well. So I think that's what he's talking about more than anything else. Generally, there are just players who, you know, the way that their natural bat flow works might be more likely to bring the ball back onto the stumps. People who play with an angled bat more often are more likely to hit the ball back onto the stumps. People who pull the ball quite often can be those sorts of players. So, I think, from a front foot perspective, what he's talking about is more just if you get an inside edge, it comes onto your pad rather than going back onto your stumps. Players don't really have that technique anymore. Like, I can understand why he would say that as a player who played in that era. There really aren't the forward press, the sort of, would Rahul Dravid might be the last of that sort of dying breed that gets a long way forward against quick bowling at the test level. I just don't think we see much of it anymore. But I can understand generally what he's saying as well. If you have your bat and pad together, it's much harder for the ball to hit the inside edge and just go back onto your stumps. Limit says, who would you rather have in your cricket team in their prime, McGrath or Cummins? Includes batting, bowling and fielding. Captaincy if required. Well, McGrath didn't captain, so that was unfair. In their prime. Yeah, Cummins obviously a better fielder than McGrath and a better batter. I'd still take McGrath. I think McGrath has an argument to be the greatest new ball bowler in the history of cricket. And I just think that we're doing a piece at the moment about the winningest players. And we didn't talk much about McGrath, but I was looking at some of his stats. When he took bags, Australia just won at a ridiculous rate, right? And I think that's because when he takes his wickets, and I think Sean Pollock was up there as well. Those are guys who took very, very new ball wickets. And if you could have the other team 10 for three, you know, and I don't think that's Cummins' main skill set. So maybe you could argue that Cummins is a harder cricketer to find than McGrath. There are lots of new ball bowlers, but McGrath might still be the greatest new ball bowler that's ever existed. Alex says, I watched some of your stick to cricket clips. How are you able to stomach Vaughan for so long? Who's the Aussie sat behind you? He seemed more accurate in his predictions than you. That was just a fan. Yeah, we recorded that a couple of weeks out. I can't remember what his predictions were, but I mean, he was just a fan who was going to say Australia was going to win. I can't remember what his predictions were, to be honest. I can't remember what my predictions were. Alex, you got to remember, man, you just go on these things and they ask you questions and you give them stuff. I mean, I've done heaps of predictions. Those predictions might not have even matched predictions I've done on other things. I think fans get really obsessed with this. No one I've ever met in the media spends more than a couple of seconds thinking about their predictions. Right? Because it's not even the major part of your job. My job is to be on their show. So I present Stick to Cricket for, I don't know, let's say 2 hours. The predictions is like 3 minutes. It doesn't mean anything, right? Fans get really upset. They're like, you said this would happen and this happened. I'm like, yeah, if you want someone to predict the future, like, don't follow sport. No one can predict the future. Rob Barron probably wins like 55% of his bets, right? Like, this is not how these things work, right? But yeah, I don't know Michael Vaughan very well. He was fine on that show. We didn't spend a lot of time together because he came in after me and he was in one green room and I was in another green room because Will McPherson was on. I barely saw Will and he was sitting next to me, I think. So we're basically on air with each other. I think I spoke to Vaughnie for like 10, 15 seconds between one of the recordings. I spoke to Tuffers for a couple of seconds and they were fine. You know, I mean, we didn't have deep and meaningfuls or anything. And I spoke to Will a little bit and I spoke to the Barmy Almond trumpeter a bit as well. But yeah, it was interesting doing it in front of a crowd. I thought it was a really interesting concept. Sashimi says, do you think the IPL is wrong in trying to create a parody league where every team can win? Leagues need a narrative. We need dynasties and a massive underdogs. I don't understand why people don't understand that there are already like massive underdogs and dynasties. Like that's already there. That's why RCB doesn't win so special in a close league with only 10 teams. They were bound to win once by just sheer chance. That's every league when it starts, Sashimi. I think you're just missing. You're comparing it to other leagues where there are like, they've been going on forever. Any league where you have this, this is why the RCB thing was in that sort of situation. But yeah, I think you've just misunderstood what a new league is. A new league is generally you don't have a lot of teams and everyone has a chance of winning. And the teams who don't are kind of fluky in the fact that they don't, right? Like Delhi would now be the team you look at and be like, probably should have won early on. They could have won when they had that incredible young core that they didn't quite turn into a title. But where's this parity league I'm looking at? How many of the championships have been won by three teams? It's not a parity league at all. I think people have... the idea of a league is you try and strive towards parity, but you understand that no matter what you do, there is always going to be a Man City, there is always going to be an LA Lakers, there is always going to be a Mumbai Indians, right? That is just a normal part of these sorts of things. But if you don't strive towards it, and like you end up with a team winning like 60% of the times, people will turn off, right? And also, what happens when those teams are not playing? You need to be able to make money all the time, not just when the main teams are playing. So yeah, every team should be striving towards parity while knowing there is no way to be to have parity. There is just no system that works, right? But that is the goal here. MF Jim says, could the more normal bounce of Adelaide now catch out England after two of the bounciest wickets in Australia? No, I don't think so. I mean, generally, you know, if you look traditionally, teams have really enjoyed the fact that they can go back to maybe the SCG and the Adelaide Oval a little bit, just because it feels a little bit more like normal cricket. There's still more bounce. I think Australians think it's not bouncy. It's still probably more bouncy in Adelaide and the SCG than most cricket grounds in the world, right? But yeah, I think if you're an overseas player, you're like, okay, this feels a little bit more normal to me. That's all you're looking for, right? Just normality. Pub says, an argument you usually hear against Bradman is that cricket as a sport wasn't fully professional at the time. What point would you consider cricket to be fully professional, at least among test-playing nations? Yeah, I mean, the argument for Bradman is that he was professional in an era when everyone else was amateur. No one ever says that. No one ever says that about the early women's cricketers or Bradman or Grace or whatever, in that they actually strive to be the best that they could be in a period where not everyone did. And I don't know why that isn't the counter argument there. And this is the other thing. When does cricket become professional is not an easy question to answer, Puff, right? There is an element of professionalism that comes in probably late 90s, early 2000s, where I think certainly Australia is professional at that point. The West Indies are professional by default because of overseas jobs and leagues and everything else that they're playing in, you know, so I think there's an element of that within the West Indies. I think by 2005 to 2010, a lot of teams are professional and are paid, and that is their main job and they don't need a second job. So maybe by 2010. So that means in that case, then Sachin Tendulkar didn't play in the professional era. And I've never heard anyone say that that is the case. So yeah, it's a tricky one, professionalism. I kind of respect the people in the amateur days who took it seriously when other people didn't, right? I mean, in Bradman's case and Grace's case, it eventually made them rich, right? Let's not piss about here. But there were probably other players of similar level of talent who didn't make that kind of money because they didn't take it as seriously. So, yeah, it's a weird one. I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that Dennis Lilly bowling to Viv Richards in, what, 75, 76, 76, 77, whenever that series was, is not one of the, you know, those sorts of contests and, you know, Gordon Greenidge and Tomo. Those sort of comments, and the same of Greg Chappell facing Andy Roberts, right? That is not like top level sport, right? That happened in the 70s. Wes Hall bowling to what? Was Hall? Garfield Sobers up against Neil Harvey, right? I find it hard to think that that wasn't. Now, there is an element, of course, that can be said that amateur cricket or amateur sport in general is a step down from professional cricket. And I don't think I'd argue with that. But there's also something that no one ever talks about is that rugby union had a huge advantage by staying amateur as long as it did, because the people who came in weren't just cricket or weren't just rugby union people. They had gone off and lived other lives and they brought other concepts into their sport. And if you go back and you look at amateurism in general, like I think New Zealand is a famously amateur team in the 1980s and they were the third best team in the 1980s. England weren't. England players didn't really need secondary jobs unless they wanted them at that point. County cricket certainly paid enough by that period. And if you're a regular England player, you would have got, you know, other income coming in. You didn't need a secondary job. Your wife didn't need to work in that period where, you know, maybe your wife didn't always work as well. Like you would have lived a really comfortable life as a top eight English cricketer. And even as a top 20 English cricketer, probably county rates were okay. There might've been some in, you know, and maybe you would have to go off and play in Australia or South Africa or Zimbabwe, you know, New Zealand in the off season a little bit, but you could still be a pretty well paid cricketer at that point, right? And yet New Zealand were a better team than England, and New Zealand players weren't paid to play domestically, and they basically weren't paid to play internationally if you look at the fees that they were getting, right? So we always have to be careful with this. And you look at it with the great, you know, I've done lots of work on the great women's cricketers who were amateur. They didn't suddenly try harder when they were professional. Susie Bates prepared like a professional beforehand, right? And so I have an issue with this. Your job as a cricketer is to be better than the other cricketers around you at any particular time. You're always going to have advantages and disadvantages, right? But that is your job as a cricketer, right? And a lot of those cricketers who are amateur played cricket in the amateur era like it was a war. Right, like as far as their mentality was going, like, you know, there was not an inch given. Whereas professional players don't play it like that. They can't, because it would just drain them. They would not be able to do it. So there was more of a contest at times in the amateur era than there was in professional. But at the same time, Bradman probably went up against a school teacher who isn't spending as much time refining his bowling. Like all of these things are true at the same time. Rohit says, would South Africa trade Tony DeZorzi for two up-and-coming Sri Lanka spinners for a white ball-only deal? Does Sri Lanka want Tony DeZorzi in white ball cricket? I wouldn't have thought that that's like in that kind of a trade. Let me just look at his numbers. I think they've got a good young core. I mean, he is young. What is he, 26, 27? Oh, he's 28, just turned 28. So he's a little bit older than I thought. What's his list A record? 38, strike rate of 87. No, I'm probably not doing that. Also, don't South Africa have good spinners at the moment? That's a no from both sides for me. James says, alternate history, Australia appoints Bob Simpson as coach as soon as Greg Chappell retires instead of 2 years later. How does this affect the team's performance? Defections to South African rebel teams, Kim Hughes and Alan Border's careers? I don't know. I think when Bob Simpson came in, you've got to understand that there is a history between Bob Simpson and the Chappells. Because of what happened with World Series cricket, which I'm assuming is still happening in this world, this make-believe world that you've come up with, although I could be wrong. There's a history there, and so I think that obviously would have played a part, although, as you said, Greg Chappell has retired instead of two. But yeah, I think there's a history of that, so I think there's a bit of an issue going on between the Chappells and the Simpson side of things. I think probably Bob Simpson needed a younger side because they needed to buy into something that hadn't existed before. So I'd have to go back and look at the ages of all those players and where they were. I think realistically, though, there was a bit of a talent drain in Australian cricket between the sort of 30 to 34-year-old guys and the 18 to 23-year-old guys. That's sort of the era between sort of the Boone, Steve Waugh, Dean Jones age guys and the Greg Chappell, Rod Marsh type guys. I think there was just a period where they didn't produce as many strong cricketers at that point. So I'm not sure that Bob Simpson would have changed it all that much, but it's hard. You know, I'd have to go back and have a look at all the different players who are available. Hurt says, what's up with pitch reports these days? This is the worst Seinfeld bit I've ever heard. Were they always this hit and miss, or is there something now causing all this variability? How can they be better? They can't be better. It's nonsense. Why are you listening to them? This goes back to the predictions thing that, you know, before of like, your job is to commentate. It's like, it's a strip of grass in front of you. Like, I've seen professional cricketers who had like 50 years of experience look at it and be like, I know this ground so well, it's going to do this, and it does the opposite. Of course. How could they predict it? If they could predict it, they would just, they'd be billionaires betting on cricket, right? Like, I think people just misunderstand what a prediction is. A pitch report is, okay, I kind of know a little bit about this wicket. This is what it looks like. This is what it might do based on me touching it. Okay. Well, if everyone knew that, every team would get the toss right every time. And every team does not get the toss right every time. It's just guessing, guys, right? I think if you wanted it, you could say that there is, you could use more data, and they should probably use more data, the commentary teams. But what do they care? I just don't understand what the, it's just, realistically, you could use all the data in the world and still be wrong. Reese says, did batters pre-DRS have to train their brain not to snap their head back to the keeper when they edge the ball? I ran a nuance in the game that has died with DRS. Did you hear of people being conscious of this? Yeah, that was something we were taught in club cricket. Reese, back in Australia in the day, was try if you know you've edged it, try not to look behind, right? Like train yourself to look straight down the wicket no matter what's happened. Until you hear like a commotion behind you, like as in, that was the thing that I was always taught in my club, which was if you think you've hit it or if you don't think you've hit it, wait until you hear something behind you that doesn't sound like an appeal or a catch, because that might mean that there's a chance of overthrows, or that might mean, a fumble or a drop catch or whatever. But yeah, we were always told to just continue to look straight down. And I think that is certainly an art that is, I don't know, you know, how easy it is. I think with some people, it's just automatic, because it's almost it's an instinctual thing, right? Of like, oh, are they going to catch it? And I think by the end of my career, it was very rare that I would look at a fine edge when I hit behind. And I probably fooled more umpires than I deserve to have because of that. Josh says, I enjoyed your Crick Picks episode of the all-time Bazball 11. A few months ago, I made my own stylistic 11 based on the three Fs, fielding, fun, and fucking good at cricket. What changes would you make to my three Fs 11? Hayden, Warner, Ponting, Viv, AB de Villiers, Stober, Gilly, Pollock, Warne, Garner, Bolt. So you need to be good at fielding. You need to be fun. I think I'd have Trumper there. Ponting, Viv, AB seems fine. Sober seems fine. I'm trying to think if you want fun, you know, Leary Constantine is probably another player. Like, I'd have Leary Constantine in ahead of Sean Pollock as that kind of player. Would you have... I think Brendan McCullum's more fun than Adam Gilchrist. He's merely... He's not as good a fielder as Warne. He's more... Maybe Warne was more fun as a bowler. I'm not sure I would think of Garner as fun. Bolt, because of his batting and his fielding, I'm okay with. Not sure if I say as fun, but certainly he's got a lot there. If instead of Garner, who would you have? Like, Shoaib Akhtar? Can't field, but he's fun. I may have ruined this for you, Josh. Hertz says, now that tracking data lets us see exactly where the ball goes soft or loses movement, I'm not sure it tells us if the ball's gone soft that well. Like, I'm not sure that's what tracking data can do. It certainly tells us when it loses movement. I'm curious to know, did you find any material from pre-TV era while researching for your books on people talking about swing or seam dying soon or lament the lack of movement back then? Yeah, it's always been the same. There are some balls that you pick up and they don't swing, and some don't swing seam. And there was always talk about the Kookaburra, you know, being a ball that only swung for a few overs. Most of those things are pretty consistent throughout the history of cricket. We just now have some data to back them up, I suppose, is the main difference between those. You're watching The Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back after this. I have travelled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things, the phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny sims and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally. Jeremy says, what do you make of the part-time bowlers during the last few overs of session strategy? So, Jeremy, I've looked at this before. Batters are incredible at not going out right before breaks. There's obviously a couple of players who always struggled with that. But I think I'm pretty sure that there was a guy who went and did this really deep analysis, and I wish I remember who he was now, but he looked specifically at what the time that players went out and when the breaks came and everything, and he somehow worked out the data, and players do not go out right before breaks. So there is an element to the truth of the way that cricket is, which is if you can break their cycle of concentration and bring on someone else, maybe that doesn't matter as much, right? So I can see that. I think, you know, there are probably times when it works and probably times when it doesn't. They're probably the right kind of part-timers. I mean, part-time as a general rule is a dying art these days. So maybe it doesn't matter as much anymore. But yeah, this is certainly a thing that I think can work. And I can understand if you have the right kind of bowler why you could use it. PJ says, if you had to guess, what is the most common technical flaw for an elite batter that leads to a dismissal? I'm going to guess that it's something like dangling the bat to a seeming delivery around the four stump line, not getting into position, not moving head, hands, feet. Depends what you mean by technical. I would say the biggest issue that happens in cricket is people defending balls they don't need to defend. I remember talking to Trent Woodhill about this years ago, and he was, you know, he works with obviously Williamson, Warner, Smith, Virat. You know, he's kind of, I think everyone, maybe not Root. But like a lot of big name players, Watson was another one, right? And a lot of the IPL guys, Travis Head was another one he worked with, right? And his big thing was like, especially in Test cricket, of saying, do I need to play it? Do I not need to play it? Do I need to defend it? Do I not need to defend it? And do I need to score from it, right? And so he basically would say to these players, that's a leave, that's a block, that's runs. And I think that some players get in a mindset of like having defending balls they don't need to. And once you start, I mean, what you're talking about here is that defending the ball around the four stump line. It's actually probably further than that, right? The four stump line you want to defend, but it's when you see players defending on the fifth or sixth stump or the back of a length where you think to yourself, well, you don't need to defend that. Your better option is to not play it or to try and score off it. And I think that that's probably, and I don't know if you count that as a technical issue, but that's probably where these things come from, because if you're going to take a risk with a ball that you don't have to hit, your best risk is to try and score off it and not defend it. Once you get that bat outside of your eye line, it's very easy to block the ball when it's on the stumps, right? You're still going to miss some and you're still going to get bowled. But the vast majority of bowls are probably people playing some kind of a shot to them, right? Like we'd have to have a look at that with data, but maybe, you know, something for Varun one day. But I would say the vast majority would be in that sort of situation. But once you start blocking the ball away from your eye line, you might as well actually play an attacking shot. And so I'd say that's probably the biggest issue in cricket, especially against fast bowling. I don't know what it would be in spin cricket. Against spinners, it's probably not going far enough forward or not playing far enough back. It's that middle ground probably for spin. Prudvi says, probable quick picks topic as well. So if you have these, Prudvi, and you're on the Discord, there's a Discord channel that you can put them in directly at, and just tag Bayram, which is probably Def Mango or whatever he is there. Who was the best, worst-looking batter? Inspired by Jadeja, for me, he always looks like he's stiff doll without any moving joints when he's batting. Yeah, he's got that kind of Alan Border sort of jolty style, which I actually really like. Aesthetically, weirdly, but I can understand most people don't. Yeah, you would probably have it's Graham Smith or Shivnarine Chandrapal. You would put Simon Cadditch up there. I'm trying to think of some of the old ones. Ijaz Ahmed would be a great one to look at. Alistair Cook is probably one that a lot of people would have on that list. I can't remember where I have those guys, but it's probably Cook or Smith. It's probably the most of the other top 20 players of all time. Or top 25 are pretty aesthetically pleasing. You know, they play with straight lines. It's the ones that don't play with straight lines that I think start to sort of get to you, I think, a little bit more. And so I don't mean like Viv Richards or KP flicking across the line. I kind of mean the angled bat and the sort of, you know, if you think, you know, Graham Smith never met a ball he didn't want an inside edge to backward square leg for one, right? Like it's that. Cam says, and is it just me, or would no one be surprised if England make 600 in Adelaide and win by an innings? It still seems to be that on paper, England's top seven is considerably better than Australia's. I know that's crazy. I don't think it was ever... I don't know if I agree with you on paper. I think on form, right, and depth, I think we thought England had a more interest, or and a mode even. England had more. Like Australia's top three was all over the place coming into the series, right? You know, Usman Khawaja was out of form. Weatherall was going to be making his debut. Manus was an opener recently and had been dropped from the side and was coming back. But on paper, that's still Usman Khawaja and Manus Labuschagne, right? So I don't know if, whereas you're going up against Ollie Pope and Zach Crawley, right? So it's a big difference. I'm not sure I agree with you on paper, but those players were more comfortable. I mean, I wanted to do a video at one stage about really how interesting the series has been, that a lot of the weaknesses we thought England had, perhaps had. So things like I was talking about, I wasn't sure if Brooke and Smith were quite at the level everyone else thought they were. And there might be a regression there. Well, that's regressed, right, so far. A lot of people very excited about, you know, Crawley finally coming to Australia. And again, what, you know, Duckett, who has been one of the best openers in the world, other than Jaiswal over the last couple of years, suddenly not making any runs, right? Like there's been a lot of regression in things that we didn't even think they would have a regression in, and also regression in things that were possible. The bowlers being one-dimensional have been completely found out so far, being one-dimensional, right? By the way, it's funny, people go, oh, your prediction's wrong. I literally predicted a bunch of these things were possible beforehand. The bowling attack I'm fucking droning on about also predicted Lyon would be dropped. Anyway, I don't know why people care about this. So I'm not sure if I agree with you on paper, but you're right. I mean, at the moment, Weatherall is overperforming. Travis Head is out of position and is doing magical things. They haven't really had to rely on Green or Inglis all that much, and Carey's helped them out a couple of times, right? So I still think there's issues with the Australian batting lineup. They haven't been solved by Head opening the batting, and he may not even stay opening the batting, right? So I think a lot of what you said there, Cam, is fair, and I'm kind of on your side with that. But right at the moment, it has flipped, and it does feel like Australia is the more comfortable team, the more settled team. And there's a bunch of English players. I think Zach Crawley, Harry Brooks, definitely thinking to themselves, oh shit, this is harder than we thought it was going to be. I think Jamie Smith is trying to work out if he's still Jamie Smith, right? So I think there's quite a bit. Ollie Pope might get dropped, right? Wait, they have released the side, haven't they? I should know that. England, Adelaide, Test team. I meant to look at that before we came on. So Ollie Pope's still in. So yeah, so he might get dropped for a future Test match, right? Like, again, that's where they are at the moment. I still think that's why when I put the rush line thing up at the start, Cam, I was like, I think 10%, I think there's something in that, right? I think England, I could see why the AI thinks that, and I can see why the general consensus of smart cricket minds might agree with these sorts of numbers. Australia 72% chance of winning and England a 10% chance of winning. But I do think there is an element of this might be their pitch that suits them the most in this series outside of Perth, which they already bugged up. But this might be the other one. And also, so many things have gone in Australia's favour, right, that you could make an argument that only a few need to come back and England are playing good cricket. The issue is Australia, right? That's really where the issue is with this sort of stuff, because generally what happens, Cam, is once they get down in Australia, they don't come back, right? And I think that's the big one. And that's why, that's why everyone kind of believes that and everything else. But I think it's fascinating. You say they win by an innings. I don't think they can bowl Australia out cheaply enough with their bowling attack to win by an innings at this stage. Abe says, you may have answered this elsewhere. Probably. But if you had to pick one, what's the single most underrated test innings of the 21st century so far, and why? For me, it's between Mo and Ellie's 108 at Headingley and AB de Villiers' 91 at Centurion. AB de Villiers' 91 at Centurion would probably be my list. Yunus Khan at Kandy is another one that I don't think gets talked about a lot. What did they have to chase? 350, 380? That's another one that it's like the two guys who did their chases 9 wickets down, everyone's like, oh, isn't that incredible? Well, Yunus controlled the game so much that they didn't even look like getting a wicket there, Sri Lanka. That's another one that instantly comes to mind. There's a 80-odd that Sehwag plays. I can't remember where it was, but it was against England when India had a really good chase. India beat England. I think Sachin might have made the 100, but Sehwag just destroyed England in like spiritually. That was an incredible innings. There's a Mark War, or actually, what year would that have been? That might have been the 90s. Mark War again, I want to say in their fourth innings against South Africa when they tend to chase 280. Maybe that was 98. I can't remember. That's another one that comes to mind. Oh, Kumar Sangakkara against Australia and Hobart is one that certainly comes to mind. Trying to think of some others. Yeah, so there's a bunch there. Moen Ali's 108 versus Sri Lanka at Headingley. Oh, that's the one where Sri Lanka still win, isn't it? Yeah, that's a really, really good one as well. I'm trying to think of some others. There's probably a bunch of like Smith and Root, Coley Williamson ones where the team, Smith at Edgbaston, I suppose, is one. Like those sorts of innings, which, because they're not fourth innings, they don't always instantly stick in your mind. Aravind says, England, and in particular Zach Crawley's love of driving on the up, has been discussed to death over the past few weeks. However, isn't driving in general, and the cover drive specifically, Crawley's great superpower in his heyday, several of which were probably on the up, including in his successes down under? Is it just Crawley being a better player that allows him to do that compared to Crawley's of the world? No, so the big difference is, Zach Crawley's big skill is, well, it's twofold. It's that 90 mile an hour bowling doesn't seem to bother him as much as other people. And that because he's so tall, he could take a step down and he can make a ball that is not a half volley into a half volley for him. And it's an incredible skill to be able to have. And it's why he's playing in Test cricket, even though he's been struggling so far in his career, right? That's why we know who he is, right? Because even with one of those skills on their own, you kind of need both. So I think that's a big part of it. And everything else. The issue in Australia is that with the extra bounce, you are driving at balls that are more likely to get an edge than you are in any other country on earth. And so a lot of Australian cricketers will tell you that you only drive when it's overpitched. And if you go back and look at Crawley, he's not driving this. I mean, we'd have to look at the data on this, but if you had a Hawkeye data, I'd be shocked if Crawley is driving anywhere near the length that Zach Crawley is. And that's because Zach Crawley is driving the same sort of length that he would in other countries, but that extra bounce is just getting edges. Whereas what Crawley is probably doing, my guess is waiting for the balls to be overpitched into what is probably still on the up, right? But it's on the up safe enough for someone of his skills. Whereas Zach Crawley is trying to play on the up when it's probably unsafe for any player ever to drive. Right. There's also another element I would think of that, and you'd have to go back and have a look at the blade, but Zach Crawley is very rarely has a straight blade when he does this. So in Australia with the extra bounce, there's always a chance of getting an edge, right? I suppose Crawley at his absolute best is probably more straight because of the way he plays, is probably much more of a straight bladed player. That, again, just a guess, a little bit out of my ass there, but I would say that. But yeah, in general, you can drive in Australia. There are, you know, Greg Chappell was a great driver. Michael Slater was a great driver. Lots of Australians are great cover drivers. Mike Hussey would play that cover drive. You know, Matthew Elliott, you know, I'm trying to think of other right-handers as well. You know, Michael Clark. Lots of players could drive and cover drive, right, in Australia. But they are waiting for the ball to be in their area. And Zach Crawley is trying to turn a ball that is not into his area into that because he does it in other places. And it's much harder to do that in Australia. You know, there's a running joke, especially, you know, that you just don't drive on day one on Australian pitches in general until you're sure you know what the bounce is like. Karen says, you and Robbie pondered over who's the third seamer for India now. Does Ashish seem not make the cut in Test cricket? He has a first-class bowling average of 30. He's 26 years old. A left-arm swing bowler, should do well in centre countries, right? I think, I don't want to speak for Robbie here. My issue with Ashish is that I still don't think he's accurate enough for Test cricket. I think his best ball is definitely Test cricket worthy, but he can still spray the ball around a little bit. And I don't think he has like magical control, right? And I think if you're going to bowl at his pace with his lengths, because he has to overpitch it to swing the ball, I think you have to be more accurate. And I think that would be the issue that I would have for him. The fact that he can swing the ball both ways and has nice energy off his ball, is not slow, I think I'm okay with. But most of the times I have issues with Ashdeep, it's because I think he just struggles a little bit with his accuracy at that time for that kind of bowler. If you're a swing bowler, so if you're a wobble ball bowler, you only kind of need to bowl like, you can bowl a pretty safe delivery, right? Let's call it the Scott Boland ball, right? Not much can go wrong with that. And so even if you're a wobble ball bowler who's not brilliantly accurate, I think of someone like Matthew Potts, he's there and there and about. When you're a swing bowler, you have to bowl a lot fuller. So you cannot overpitch as often. And if you do overpitch or you do give it too much width, you're now in a position where you can just be absolutely slaughtered. And if you think about our sheep's worst days, I think it's that. The fact that he averages 30 in first-class cricket, I need a deeper dive on. I still think he can play. I think he's good enough to play. At 26, he's like a really experienced cricketer. I'd be fascinated to see how he bowls in first-class cricket. I haven't seen a lot of it. He's on the list, but lots of guys are on the list. Alex says, England are probably going to lose 5-0 or 4-1. Be careful, Alex. Now you're making predictions. Regime changes often follow a whitewash. Where did England go in this case? No obvious replacement for Stokes. So Baz probably goes. Who would you choose to replace him? I think actually Rob Key, McCullum, and Stokes might go. Because I think Stokes might go on his own. I think that's a possibility. You're right. I don't know who you give the captaincy to. Is it Brooke who's coming off his first? Like, let's say Brooke continues to have a bad series. That's an interesting one to give to him. It's Smith. You give it back to Root. Like, it's Pope. It's not ideal, is it? So they might try and keep Stokes around. McCullum's interesting too, because they just made him the white ball coach, right? That's awkward. You know, with Brendan McCullum, I think the new style of cricket suits English grounds and it suits the skill sets that English players have coming through the system. So I want someone who's going to embrace that, but try and make it smarter, right? That's the, I'm not giving you a name because I don't know who that is, but I would be looking at it going, okay, so what's our next generation? Where are we now? Where do we want to be? Do we want a coach who's going to actually upskill some of these players, or do we want someone who's going to tell them they're all wonderful? Both of those options are available to you. Do we want a shouty coach now because they've had the feel good coach, right? Like whatever it is, I think you probably want someone who is like, yeah, I want to play attacking cricket too, right? But I want to play smarter attacking cricket, and here's my theory on how we can do it, and here's how I think I will mesh with the players who are available. That's the person you're looking for, right? I don't know if there's an individual name of a coach out there that I'm like, oh, you have to hire him, but that's the sort of person I'm looking for. Sashimi says, when I was growing up, test match bowling attacks used to be four bowlers. What was the logic in having limited overs cricket being a five bowler game? Like, I understand during the early days of ODIs where you could get away with the fifth bowler being a part-timer. I mean, you couldn't, Sashimi, as I think the West Indies proved that quite early on. But yeah, I know your point. The team's definitely tried it a lot more. But with T20s, it doesn't make sense to increase the max limit for each bowler to five overs. It would increase the quality of cricket without having to introduce impact subs or other silly rules. Yeah, I kind of agree. I think you'd have to go back. I think this was an English rule, Sashimi. Maybe they were a bit more all-rounder coded at that point. If you go back to English cricket in the 50s, into the 60s, I would have thought they probably had a few all-rounders available to them, right? I'm trying to think of, you know, Basil D'Oliveira would be one. Trevor Bailey. Don't want to say Trevor Bailey. When was Trevor Bailey playing for them? He would have been 50s into the 60s, wouldn't he? Yeah, and for those first-class teams, it's actually, it's interesting, actually, your question, because you say when you grew up, Test cricket was like that. First-class cricket's never been like that. And limited overs cricket started as a domestic game. Most domestic teams have five bowlers, especially in England, because you exhaust your bowlers because you're playing 3 days on, 3 days, 1 day off, 3 days on, three, you know, like they played so much cricket, right? Like I think there was an element in first-class cricket around the world, you will find more fifth bowlers than you would have in Test cricket. So I wonder if that has played a part as well. But yeah, I've said this many times before. I don't really understand it. There was one really good rule they did in domestic Australian cricket. I want to say late 90s, early 2000s. Actually, it might have been later than that. It might have been later on. But it was your four frontline bowlers could bowl 12 overs each, right? I think that was the ruling. And then you had to make up the rest. It was something like that anyway. I thought, again, that was a little bit more interesting, but I'm kind of with you. I think we'll get to substitutions anyway, regardless of this. But yeah, I've always thought it was a bit of an arbitrary mark, and no one's probably ever, questioned it a little bit, but I think you're probably right. MF Jim says, after Alex Carey's masterclass last test, could we see keepers up the stumps to 140 kilometres become more prevalent? MF Jim, go back. I wrote about this 3 years ago. The minute England started using their feet in test cricket, I said this was an inevitability, right? While it's been done before, could this be the right timing with batters moving more, or is it just such an elite skill dependent on the person behind the stumps? Yeah, it is. So Blundell's done it. Carey's done it. It's really hard for most other keepers, right? I'm trying to think of some others, but it's not as easy. There's also Asian keepers don't always do it just because the ball is a little bit lower. So the consistency of the bounce isn't always there. It skids a little bit more. So even though Asian keepers probably have the skill set to do it, they don't do it. Whereas Australian wickets, weirdly enough, even with the extra bounce, you know it's going to be a consistent bounce. So, you know, we have seen Australian keepers do this a lot. But yeah, I think this is the next big change. And then we see this might be the movement back towards wicket keepers who can bat rather than batters who can wicket keep, right? That might be the big change that, you know, when I did my huge essay years ago, you know, point fielders with gloves, I was saying there has to be a change in order for us to go back to wicket keeping. This might be it, because it seems to bother a lot of these players that the wicket keeper is up. And I remember traditionally, I always thought this was a good thing, but then again, I was always a player who would bat out of my crease. And so it changed the way I batted when a wicket keeper came up to the stumps. And that's not always the case for everyone. I can definitely understand this, but it's a very hard skill, but I think it might be the next generation of wicketkeeping is if you can do that, it changes, it gives you another bowling option because it's a different kind of bowling. James says, you missed this one last time. To be fair, there were heaps. To be fair, also StreamYard sometimes just swallows questions. So sorry about that. Rate and rank the understudies to Healy. Tim Zura, he was the best bat. Darren Berry, he was the best wicketkeeper. Phil Emery and Wade Seccombe were both solid. I probably, if I was putting wicketkeeping and batting together, maybe it's Emery or Seccombe. If it's batting, it was definitely Zura. And if it was wicketkeeping, it's definitely Berry. So it just depends on how you want to pick your side, right? It's a real shame we didn't see, if Darren Berry was like, if the Big Bash existed during Darren Berry's career, I mean, you talk about wicketkeepers keeping up the stumps to 130 kilometers an hour. Like, that was just something that Darren Berry did regularly in a period when no one did it. And he was brilliant at it, right? You know, him and Jack Russell were so far ahead of the game when it came to that and being able to handle that extra pace. He was an absolute genius. And we never got to see that much because almost none of his games are broadcast. Reese says, can you think of an innings where a batter has batted well in conditions that completely does not suit their technique? Not saying he's particularly special, but always thought it was a miracle Nasser made 100 in Australia, given how low his hands were in his pickup. Yeah, I think Navjot Sidhu made 100 in the West Indies, which is kind of against what you would assume from Navjot Sidhu. Ricky Ponting made 100 in India with the sort of poking himself at the ball way that he played spin. Yeah, I mean, there's probably plenty of them. If you're a professional batter, sometimes people just drop you and you know how to get through the gears, or the bowling rotations suit you on a certain day. So yeah, I think there are lots of situations. It's very rare for a professional batter not to be able to make runs in a location, right? As a professional international level player, if you've played 40 or 50 test matches, you probably have the skill to make 100 everywhere. But, you know, it's just going to be a lot harder in certain situations than it is in others, is probably the way that I would look at that. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Josh says, is there any chance that England are so mentally broken after losing the Ashes 5-0 that they also lose to New Zealand 3-0 at home? They've been pretty good at home outside of what? India and Australia? So they've drawn series with Australia. They should have lost the series to India, but then the baseball thing sort of helped them out. And there was another series that India played really good in England, right? Like, I'm trying to remember back. But there is a series that New Zealand beat them at home, isn't there? I suppose if New Zealand's bowling attack is fully fit, if Jameson and Henry and, you know, Will O'Rourke and whoever else you want to chuck in there are fully fit, it's better bowling attack than England, isn't it? Right? And so, you know, some of that depends on form. It'd be really interesting, actually, Josh, to look at what England do in the series after they get smashed in Australia. Like, does it affect them? PJ says, in alternate reality, what would Shane Warne's legacy be like if Australia lost the 99 World Cup semi-final and his shoulder problems flare up again and he retires shortly thereafter? Does he still become the rock star celeb and date Liz Hurley? That would leave him with something like 200 ODI wickets at 24 and 320 wickets at 25. Yeah, I think the rock star stuff is more probably from the 90s anyway. We really hadn't had a player like that that was global. I think Botham was a similar kind of guy, but not global. Imran Khan and Kapil Dev. Sobers, but it was kind of in the newspaper day, Keith Miller in the newspaper day. So I do think the 90s sort of played a big part in Warne. He probably then becomes more of a blowhard, right? Like, as in, he's not as well respected, but he's still going to say things and, you know, he's still going to be involved in things. So he's still going to do random stuff. But yeah, like, you know, the legacy of him being a great player definitely plays a huge part in the fact that he goes on. I think this is the most underrated part of Warne. Especially if you're going Warne versus Murali. I think that Murali is a great bowler who evolves slightly with the times, like, you know, the Deucer is part of it. Maybe the angles that he bowled with DRS. But Murali is a very similar bowler from beginning to end. Shane Warne isn't. I think that Shane Warne basically has two careers. He has pre-shoulder and post-shoulder. And, you know, we had this chat with Bryce McGain after he passed away about, you know, which is the Shane Warne that you liked more? Is it the early one that just rips it sideways and you can hear the ball and everything? Or is it the later one who's more of a slider bowler, right? And it, you know, that depends on you. But I think that plays a part in everything he is. But yeah, I think he was so famous in the 90s. I don't know, like for so long. I don't think it would have affected his star. It might have affected his legacy. Prudvi says, a bit random, how many bad fielders can a team accommodate in each format? I would think a test... in tests provide a lot of hiding spaces compared to T20s. T20s, you could have two bad fielders, short third and short fine leg. Anything more than that and becomes an issue. Now, as it becomes more of a fours and sixes game, maybe less so, but there was the famous St. Lucia team the year after I left, where if that team had gone together as they put it on, as they hired the players, it would have been the worst fielding side in the history of cricket, certainly in the history of modern cricket. There's so many people who like physically couldn't move because of injuries or fitness or whatever it may be, and that would have been horrendous. You can only hide two. One day cricket, you can only hide two really now. In fact, I would say it's even, at least in T20s, it gets to a fours and sixes point of view. One day cricket, you can really run bad fielders. If you know there are pockets where they have to put them, you can certainly play a part. Having said that, generally now the worst fielders are in the ring, right? So it isn't like in the old days where, you know, Javed Meandad would be like, oh, they've got a bad fielder at deep point. I'm just going to keep hitting the ball over. Sorry, deep cover. Deep point. No, I meant deep point. I'm just going to keep hitting the ball over cover's head and walking for twos, right? That doesn't exist in the same way now as it used to. Test cricket, fielders aren't as important, like ring fielders and everything else. I think it's probably, I'd probably flip the question in test cricket is you probably want four guys who can catch. And if you don't have four guys who can catch in the cordon, that's when it becomes a bit of an issue. Or that's probably the same, four guys who can catch in the cordon or three guys off of spinners, right? If you don't have that, I think that's a bigger issue in test cricket. Cam says, the media praise Stokes and Jacks for digging in on day four in Brisbane, but I feel like not many are mentioning how this is totally against Stokes' mantra from the last 4 years. How would the likes of Pope, Crawley and Jamie Smith be feeling after they've been lambasted for getting out playing the way they have been told by Stokes and McCullum, and then seeing Stokes being praised for doing the opposite of that? So I actually think, Cam, a lot of people haven't been paying attention to this, but I've said it before. Stokes's strike rate hasn't really changed pre and post best ball. And he's always been willing to block. I think they realized in that situation that the only chance they had of winning the game in their minds was for Jacks and Stokes to still be batting under the darkness, right? And you can argue that that's the wrong decision. I think John Norman was like, why not just try and hit 150 runs before then and, you know, see how that leads you? But you can understand why they went about it from that position. I also think that the ball had got soft. It was actually, this is what I think, Cam, you really got to pay attention. Stokes actually batted quite slowly in the first innings. He really, he went in. He's willing to do that on occasion. he often plays against type. Weirdly, at the start of best ball, he was the one that went crazy. So he quite often plays those adult roles. And I just think this was more to do with that kind of where the game was there. Abe says, your Sri Sands piece might be my favorite of all that you've written. The dog rescue sequence alone is phenomenal. If you don't mind me asking, roughly how many drafts did that go through and what changed the most between the first and the final one? Is there anything you left out of the piece, a scene or detail that you would have liked to have kept in? That was quite a while ago now. The Sri Sants piece. Yeah, it was. I remember getting his phone number. I can't remember if it was Nagaraj or Sharda, but someone gave me his number and because I'd been mentioning them and they were like, you should just contact him. Like sometimes he gets back to you. And I remember I was in Australia. I don't even know what I was doing, but I was in Australia and I sent a message and he got back like 5 minutes later. like maybe not even that, like 2 minutes later, being like, yeah, I'd love to do this. And I must have been in India later in that year. I can't remember why I was in India at the time. And I really prepared that. So when I write a feature like that, I kind of write the feature before I've met the player because I want to know as much as possible. And then if the player leads me in different directions, I want to go with that. I mean, the things that I left out of that piece are probably just that there's probably 20 times when I could have told a story from that piece that would have illustrated who Sri Santh was as a person. And I probably picked 7. Because at a certain point, I feel like the audience knew who he was. But there were so many incredible moments. Like, I remember putting the vomit story in, putting the net story in, putting the lift story in, and the dog story, the dog rescue story, as you say. Like, I remember all those, right? But there was, like, everything was like that with Sri Sant. Everything was over the top and crazy and loud and energetic and dramatic. And so I could have just kept going and going and going. So I think that was the thing of like, as a writer, you're like, once I've made my point, I've made my point. And you're kind of, you don't want the whole thing to be like that because it gets a bit tiring for people. I think everything else I wanted to put in the pieces there. I was really lucky that I met some incredible, you know, I was in Kerala for like 2.5-3 days. And every time I met someone, they just had this, like I probably talked to 30 or 40 people, but I could have quoted all 30 or 40. I don't know if this is just like people from Kerala or they just, because of it's Sri Sant or whatever, but just everyone just had like a view and a thought and everything was just, I just ran into a lot of people. Like, and sometimes you don't, like, I'm trying to think of another piece where I've tried to do something similar and like, just no one gives you anything. Right. Like, and they, you know, you like asking questions. Everyone's like, yeah, he's all right. Like, yeah, we really like him. And they don't give you anything. And you just keep prodding and prodding and nothing happens. And then you come out of the other side of a piece like this one and you're in, you know, Kochi and you're just like, you ask someone and they just give you this almost like a poetic line about him. And that's what I remember about that piece more than anything. I'm like, you know, really enjoying my time there. You know, Sri Sant is an experience as a human being. But yeah, I think everything else, I think there's probably some stuff he said off the record that I probably hinted at in the piece, but that obviously, you know, I respected the fact that he had told me that off the record, but I would have really liked to have, you know, gone into that deeper, but you can't always do that, right? And so hopefully I wrote it's one of the best pieces I think I've ever written. And, you know, I would probably, I've got a book idea that no one seems that interested in, but I've always wanted to like, go and speak to all the matrixes in cricket, you know, alleged innocent, guilty, whatever it may be. I've got a relationship with a few of them randomly. And I've always thought that would be an incredible thing of going back, you know, and seeing how these things happen. And the Sri Sant piece is kind of the center of that, right? Because I've done it once, but I've only hung out with Sri Sant for like, it was only one day, but I was with him for the full day, I think. And then we spent some time on the phone because I couldn't get out to see him the next day. But yeah, It was a great piece. Thank you very much. I hadn't thought about that piece in ages. Where are we? Let's get to some super chats. Oh, I have to take the thing off the screen, don't I? We've got a few super chats here. Prudvi, he's doubling up. He's everywhere, Prudvi. People want the IPL to be like Premier League football, but they don't realize that Premier League Football League has been in operation for about 100 years for so many clubs. Yeah, that the thing that Sashimi was saying before, that's what I was kind of trying to say of like, this is still a startup. And I think people like me and Robbie and others get frustrated is we should be beyond the startup stage now. But yes, it's got a long way to go before it gets to those things. And I don't think the IPL has been very well run in a long period of time. You could argue under Lalit, it wasn't particularly well run, but it was at least charging forwards. It hasn't charged forwards in a while. And I think there's a lot of us who do a lot of, you know, cricket business stuff and understand, you know, a lot of the smarter players and, you know, people who you know, talk to people in administration. I think there's a lot of people who are like, it probably should be bigger now. Rohit says, Messi to attend India versus US T20 match, thoughts. Why can't we make teams in group stage of T20 decided by lottery like FIFA? Tired of same pairings. I have no thoughts about Messi coming to a cricket game. It's probably a sponsor thing, right? Or something to do with money. Most of these things are. Why can't we have a lottery like FIFA? Because we fix our schedules. The World Cup is fixed. It is a corrupt system that should have been eradicated years ago. But we don't do that because we have to make India play Pakistan and we kind of feel like we have to play England play Australia. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. It's a corrupt sport and no one wants to talk about it. Anyway. Rohit says, please do a watch along of Lagan. You'll love it. I may not love it. You know, there's a couple of like Bollywood films in general. Like I like a lot of different countries' cinema. You know, I've been watching, you know, Japanese and Korean films, you know, for a very, very long time. Love, you know, different periods of French and Italian cinema as well. Bollywood just never grabbed me as a national cinema thing. But yeah, there's always a chance I will watch it and I'll love it, or I'll watch it and I'll hate it. One of these things will happen. I would certainly watch it though one day. No doubt about that. It's ridiculous I still haven't watched it. PJ says, just wanted to say thanks for a great year of content. Hopefully 2026 is the year that Good Areas reaches Brian Lara's levels of Patreon support. Please tell us about your new hairstyle in great detail. Yeah, look, thank you to everyone. I don't think this is the last show of the year, but PJ's gone early here. But yeah, we'll probably at least have one more wagon wheel. I don't know exactly what will be happening over the last week because the Boxing Day test is coming up and everything else. But if I don't get a chance to say a big thank you, like I don't take this for granted. When I left Crick Info, I kind of left with a Twitter account and nothing else. And it was a good Twitter account, but unfortunately that was around the time that Twitter was starting to fail and then Elon completely tanked it. And so it wasn't really worth what it was before. And so I had to make a career out of nothing when I was basically unemployed during COVID, right? I didn't have anyone and I didn't want to go to Patreon because I felt like it was exploiting people who had always supported my stuff. But Nick was my producer, Nick McCorriston. He's no longer with us, but he's an absolute legend. And he said, look, it's a thing that people are doing now and you have this supporter group. Like, let's see, I'm still shocked that so many of you, there are people that have been supporting me since we started this. And it's allowed us to build 2 YouTube channels, a podcast network, TikTok accounts, Instagram accounts, and hopefully go beyond. Like, we're not quite ready to tell you what the plans are for next year, but I can tell you, you know, without any fear or favor, that they are much grander than what we have done so far. And I think if you've ever followed my career, you know, I kind of leave it all out on the field a little bit. And that's what we're planning on doing next year, is going sort of as hard as we can. And it's people like PJ who, I mean, look at this. This is such a gift, what he's given us here. And I always felt bad because I suppose if you look back at my career, I took money off Rupert Murdoch or Walt Disney. And I was like, more than happy to take their money, right? Like, they have lots of it. And so it's a completely different model to come back to this. But what we've been able to create, and, you know, the fact that you've supported me with my book and, you know, a couple of books, and all the different things that we've done, it's not lost on us that, like, at Good Areas, that this exists because of people like you, right, who support us. And I don't just mean the people who do it financially, because not everyone can do that. And also with India and the different things, some people just can't do it logistically, if that makes sense. But it's the people who share, who like, who comment, right? That is what Good Areas is. And to me, I've always been lucky at being able to get these sorts of fan bases, going back to Cricket with Balls, then obviously having the two Chucks, you know, Polite Inquiries, Cricket Sadist Hour, all these different things have always had this. And I think that that's obviously something I've had the ability to sort of bring out of people. But like, I'm just a dude sitting in front of a camera and several lights, too many lights, talking. And it's great to me that you all support me. My new hairstyle, I think everyone else is more interested in my hairstyle than I am. I just, you know, it got to a point where it was in front of my eyes and I thought I wouldn't mind growing it a little bit longer. So I had to brush it out of my eyes. I say brush, I use my hands to get it out of my eyes. Yeah, I don't think about my hairstyle very much at all. Jack says, King versus Cool Deep, who's better? Is there a better wristy than these two? How successful would King be in men's cricket? She wouldn't be very successful in men's cricket because the ball would be bigger and she wouldn't be able to get the revolutions on it. She's also probably a little bit too slow. I'd have to look at their numbers to see like who's better. I mean, Alana King's job is only to be better than everyone else. So maybe she's better than everyone else in a way that Cool Deep isn't in men's cricket. So maybe you would pick her, but she wouldn't be able to play men's cricket. It's a different sport and she shouldn't have to. Prudvi says, I keep hearing English batters are more talented than Aussies. At the test level of big three, is talent as big of a difference? I imagine all test players to be very talented. No, there's always difference in talent, right? Like you can have a period of time where you have, you know, a phenomenal level of talent coming through your game. And you're going to have other periods where you don't have that. I think that's very, very normal. Yeah, I'm not sure I would agree that England's batters are more talented. I just think they were informed. Like, we weren't sure that Marnus would make any runs. Weatherald had never played before. Usman Khawaja was where he was. And Head had to move positions. Grimm was batting at number three. He had to move. I think it was more about the messiness of Australian cricket, really. Carey and Smith, even Head wasn't in great form, right? Carey and Smith were the only two we were like, that makes sense. They make sense. Everyone else was a bit up and down. Ace says, when do we see salaries similar to top athletes around the world? For Premier League, NFL, and NBA for IPL players. That will happen when we play more games and when we play the players correctly. If the players were paid what they should be at the moment in the IPL, they would be on a similar wage to some of those other sports already. It's kind of ridiculous that we have this multi-billion dollar league and players are making small amounts of millions. You know, and some of it is because these players are being paid behind the scenes, but it's like a top... There's no reason why a top IPL player shouldn't be getting $35 to $40 million a year at the moment. There's just, when you look at the numbers, I don't see anything that suggests that shouldn't be the case. Ayush says, how does Australia as a team manage the morale of their players when Nathan Lyon and Usman Khawaja go to media speaking about the disappointment of being left out? Some other player is still playing. Seems a bit selfish. See, I think this is a very non-Australian thing. Because I think in Australia, this is what you want. They should be desperate to play in the team. They should be like absolutely fighting tooth and nail because they believe that if they get back in that team, they can help it. That's how we always looked at it as Australia. When I grew up, like if a guy was left out of a team and he didn't show any and he wasn't worried about it, we all went, maybe he didn't want it that much. Maybe he wasn't desperate to get in the side or maybe he's not sure he can help the side. So I actually think this is the opposite way, Ayush. No, they should be desperate to come in. His friends know he's desperate to come in. That's why he's a professional athlete who's got to the top of his sport. Typewriter says, is averaging 70 today harder than Bradman averaging 99? Given bowlers moving the ball at 140 kilometers an hour, varied conditions and detailed analysis of techniques, is it possible to be as ahead as he was of the rest? Interesting. Is averaging 70 today harder than Bradman averaging 99? No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe right at the moment, but not in the last 25 years. We had quite a few guys averaging mid to high 50s. It was quite a good right and scoring. Maybe if you just take the last 7 years, it's probably harder to average 70 right now. I think it's hard to average 99 at any stage because we've had lots of great players. Like Garfield Sobers was incredible, right? Viv Richards was incredible. Steve Smith's peak is like next worldly. Len Hutton never made mistakes. And these guys weren't even close to doing it even before the eras that you're talking about. I think the more interesting question is, can we ever have anyone else who can, let's say, average 15 with the ball, 16 with the ball, whatever that may be, and average over 70 with the bat? I think that's a more interesting question. I kind of feel like we can. Maybe I'm wrong. Ekant says, where do you see yourself in 10 years? Did you ever have a long-term career plan? I remember talking to Gideon Haig about this once, and I was like, I've got no idea what I'm doing. And, you know, blah, blah. And he goes, yeah, but you never did. And I was like, what? And he goes, but you never really had an idea of what you were doing, did you? You were just bouncing around with whatever was interesting to you. And I was like, yeah, that's probably true. And he goes, you should keep doing that. Look, there's, I think I'm probably at the stage in my career where I, if you want the lofty ambition, Ekant, it's, can I change cricket media forever? I think cricket media has been pretty shit pretty consistently for a long period of time. And I don't think that is the people who work in cricket media's fault. I think it is the way it has been structured, the international nature of it, the fact that you can always find people to do it for cheap, all these different things. But I think that because of that, we had a pretty shit cricket media. And I think there's way too much talent and interest and incredible people for that to be the case. So I think if I had a plan of where we want to be in 10 years, it would be maybe if I could get into a position where I can change cricket media. That's as bad as structured as I can give you. Did I ever have a long-term career plan? No, because I was 28 and I was parking cars for a living, right? So my career plan was getting in the media. But I think I quite often have short-term plans, you know, some of which I nailed, some of which I didn't. But yeah, I certainly had that. I probably do things differently than other people. I could be a lot more successful if I just stayed with Crick Info and managed my way up a little bit more. I probably would have been in a much better position, but that's not how I'm wired. And so, you know, I kind of end up bouncing around to these other things. But my career, my first thing was get in the industry. Then my second thing was try and be the best cricket writer in the world, right? Like, even though it's a subjective nonsense, like I needed something. Then it was like, can I do stuff that no one else has ever done consistently? Again, I think I probably nailed that one. Briefly, it was, can I just be a features writer, including in other things? That one never quite worked. Sadly, you know, I wrote some good features on other things, but they just didn't pop. And the industry was kind of dying at the time. I probably got into it about 5 years too late. If I'd gone into it 5 years earlier, I probably would have been fine. But the features, you know, industry is kind of dying. I saw the Night Watchman basically suggest they might have to close up recently, like Cricket Features and Cricket Info, Cricket Monthly, all these different things don't kind of exist anymore. And that's just in cricket, but that's kind of a global phenomenon. What else? Yeah, and then it was like, can I start a network on my own? Which again, I've done. I've made that be successful for 5 years. So yeah, I think the next one is, can I kind of change the industry a little bit? And then I've got there's some other things that I want to do outside of cricket that I haven't done yet. I've got two basically fully written novels that I've done nothing with. I've got a cricket sitcom that I'd still like to eventually get out there, and I've got a couple of movies that I've written. So a couple of things outside of those, it'd be nice if I could get one or two of those up. But one way or another, cricket always sucks me back in and I don't have the time, but let's see what the next couple of years take me. Anyway, that is it for me, my apparently new hairstyle and everything else. I think I'm just wearing a hat less as much as anything. But I'll see you again very, very soon. Me and Robbie will be back. We'll probably come back after the IPL auction. But there'll be plenty more content here, there, and everywhere. Usman Khawaja video should have just gone up. We've got a video about the two Australia and England's different relationships with the Ashes. There's a Nathan Lyon piece I'm working on, and we've got a piece on the winniest test cricketer, which will be recorded soon. So yeah, content, stories, good times, good areas. Oh, I should have used that before, shouldn't I? I'm going to write that down. Good times, good areas. But yeah, we will see you again very shortly for more of this sort of stuff. And thank you to everyone who supported us this year. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes.
Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.